Okay, so we sent out the readings, and some of them were I think very useful. And there's a particularly a description of what we've called coming to Dhamma, and it's sort of like the initial gradual training, and described very beautiful in the reading that we gave on it's in the John Bullitt's article on a gradual training. And it's right, the second quote. And I may as well just read it out because it is lovely. Monks, I do not say that the attainment of gnosis is all at once. Rather, attainment of gnosis is after gradual training, gradual action, gradual practice. And how is there the attainment of gnosis after gradual training, gradual action, gradual practice? There is the case where conviction has arisen, saddha or faith. Faith has arisen. One visits a teacher. Having visited, one grows close. Having grown close, one lends ear. Having lent ear, one hears the Dhamma. Having heard the Dhamma, one remembers it. Remembering, one penetrates the meaning of the teachings. Penetrating the meaning, one comes to an agreement through pondering the teachings. There being an agreement through pondering the teachings, desire arises. Oftentimes is written as zeal. The word is chanda, and so desire, interest, zeal. When desire has arisen, one is willing. When one is willing, one contemplates. Having contemplated, one makes an exertion. Having made an exertion or put forth effort, one realizes with the body the ultimate truth, and having penetrated it with discernment, sees it. So it's a lovely description of the reality of how one comes to the teachings, puts it into practice, and the actual, say, the quote comes from a discourse, which is actually, it's a very interesting discourse, because it's actually to a couple of monks who are not practicing the teaching. And they're actually resisting the training and disinterested in actually following how the Buddha wants his monks to train. Which is, I think it's really good for people to know that not everybody sees the Buddha, sits down, listens to one teaching, and then is enlightened. Because it doesn't happen that way. The whole body of the kind of the books on the discipline, on the training rules for monastics is there because there were stubborn, confused monastics who needed to have rules applied to them. It's also, I mean, if people didn't sort of go back and look at the sutta, it's interesting for that in the sense of this is just a vignette in the Buddha's life of these monks are not, don't want, they, what it, and it's all around eating in the evening. In the early days of the Buddha's dispensation, there really weren't any rules laid down, so that people kind of followed their own kind of style. And then the Buddha, after a while, he said, "Well, gee, this is getting a bit sloppy," and so then he said, uh, I'd like to So the Blessed One and Sangha Bhikkhus now abstain from eating at night. By so doing, they are free from illness and affliction, and they enjoy health, strength, and a comfortable abiding. Come, friends, abstain from eating at night. By so doing, you too will be free from illness and affliction. And then when this was said by other bhikkhus who saw them that they weren't following the training rules that the Buddha said sat down. And then these bhikkhus sort of said, friends, we eat in the evening, in the morning, in the day, outside the proper time. By so doing, we are free from illness and affliction, and we enjoy health, strength, and a comfortable abiding. Why should we abandon a benefit here and now to pursue a benefit to be achieved at a future time? We shall eat in the evening, in the morning, and in the day, outside the proper time. So anyway, that went to the Buddha, and he brought them back. And then he goes through giving a teaching that is encouraging them to pay attention to the fact that some kinds of pleasant feelings lead to what is wholesome, sometimes pleasant feelings lead to what is unwholesome, some unpleasant feelings actually lead to what is unwholesome, and some lead to what is wholesome. So it's not, you have to use your discernment. It isn't just according to whatever feeling you get out of an experience, you have to pay attention to the results. And then the Buddha actually goes through a very interesting description of the fruits of his practice that are, it's only described like this in a few places, so it's, and I won't start talking about it because that's a whole afternoon in itself. But it's worth, if anybody who's interested, to pick that up. And then that's where then he gives the a teaching on how does there come to be this gradual training, gradual practice, and going through all these different steps. It's a step-by-step process by which one realizes truth and penetrates with wisdom. Then, of course, he gives the admonishes the bhikkhus because of that. There has not been that faith, and there's not been that visiting. There's not been paying respects. There's not been all these. They haven't put the causes in, and you're not getting the results of the practice. So then, and he leaves it, but he does end it with when one follows the training and is willing to put forth the effort, and he's saying that for one intent on fathoming the teacher's dispensation, one of two fruits may be expected, either final knowledge here and now, or if there's a trace of clinging left, non-return. So that's the Buddha's putting his stamp or seal of his kind of guarantee on the teachings, on the fruits of the gradual path, and of course that gradual path is it begins with faith, or faith is kind of such a, it's saddha in Pali, and then how Ajahn Jeff translates it as confidence, which is a good translation. But it's a bit, say confidence is, what do you say, faith is sometimes a bit too exalted because of our background in a Judeo-Christian culture. Confidence is a bit mundane and a pedestrian, but somewhere in between. That's where it's handy to learn some of the Pali words, but anyway, one of the foundations of or the functions of faith, and this is from Anguttara, the graduated discourse, connected discourses in graduated Anguttara Nikaya. And the Buddha says, they say one of the functions of faith is that one turns toward what is wholesome and away from what is unwholesome or unskillful. And so the Buddha says, so, and this is in Anguttara 5, Sutta number 6, so long, monks, as faith exists in wholesome qualities, then what is unwholesome will not gain entry. But when faith in the wholesome has vanished and disbelief takes a hold and prevails, then what is unwholesome will gain entry. And it's very basic and very simple. But it performs such a strong function of where the mind is going to go and what it's going to take hold of and what it's going to gravitate towards. And there is the discourse itself, this one, also goes into the qualities of hiri and otapa, which are translated as sense of shame, moral dread, as well as energy or effort, and wisdom or discernment. So that when one has these, say that so long as there's wisdom concerning wholesome qualities, then what is unwholesome will not gain entry. But when such wisdom has vanished and stupidity takes a hold and prevails, then what is unwholesome will gain entry. And so that all of these different qualities, the Buddha says, these are how one balances the wholesome and unwholesome. So that, but faith in particular is sort of in terms of when you're thinking of the graduated teachings and this, so that faith is providing the seeds for the wholesome to get the ball rolling for this graduated and gradual training.
That's it. Faith in the wholesome.
That's what it says. Yeah, faith in the wholesome.
That's nice because you don't normally think of the wholesome as being something to faith in.
But it's really interesting because oftentimes it's faith is so often, say, abstracted to, say, the teacher or to faith in the Buddha, but it's really putting faith towards what is wholesome and skillful and beneficial, and you sort of say, oh yeah, I can do that. So that confidence arises. And then of course as the as we develop this, say, this gradual path and gradual training, just depending on because it's based on faith, based on drawing close to a teacher, listening to the Dhamma, hearing the Dhamma, remembering it, penetrating, contemplating it, effort arising. There's a discourse where the Buddha points to, say, the five helpers of right view. And that's Anguttara 5, Sutta number 25. And let's see. Right view, O monks, if it is helped by five things, has liberation of mind as its fruit, and is rewarded by the fruit of liberation of mind. It has liberation by wisdom as its fruit, and is rewarded by the fruit of liberation by wisdom. What are those five things? Here, monks, right view is helped by virtue, or by sila, by wide learning, by discussion of what was learned, by tranquility, and by insight. So those are, say, the aspects of developing one's sila, commitment to skillful conduct, a wide learning, taking the teachings and being involved in study and in discussion and hearing the teachings, And then by tranquility and insight are the aspects of meditation, samatha and vipassana. So those are the laying the foundation of right view. And what you're saying of these, say, the helpers, and that because our practice, all of our practice is really guided by right view. And all of our practice is guided by view. And whether it's right or wrong, the practice will go in a particular direction. So that's an aspect of you want to be putting in those conditions supporting and helping right view. Right view doesn't just sort of pop out of nowhere and all of a sudden it's there fully formed. It needs to be it needs support and needs nourishment. So again, these aspects of a gradual training. As we learn the Dhamma and study the teachings and pick up the different views and knowledge of the Dhamma, then we have to pay attention to how we're holding it. The Buddha, in Majjhima 22, which is the simile of the snake, which of course is a very, very famous simile, image that the Buddha gives. He says, "Here, bhikkhus, some misguided men learn the Dhamma, but having learned the Dhamma, they do not examine the meaning of those teachings with wisdom. Not examining the meaning of those teachings with wisdom, they do not gain a reflective acceptance of them. Instead, they learn the Dhamma only for the sake of criticizing others and for winning in debates, and they do not experience the good for the sake of which they learn the Dhamma. Those teachings, being wrongly grasped by them, conduce to their harm and suffering for a long time. Suppose a man needing a snake, seeking a snake, wandering in search of a snake, saw a large snake and grasped its coils or its tail. It would turn back on him and bite his hand or his arm or one of his limbs. And because of that, he would come to death or deadly suffering. Why is that? Because of his wrong grasp of the snake. So too, here some misguided men learn the Dhamma and those and so on and so forth. And those teachings, being wrongly grasped by them, conduce to their harm and suffering for a long time." So it's the where one lays that foundation of faith and confidence, and as one develops this gradual path, one's constantly reflecting back and seeing, am I applying it properly? Is it being put to good use? Is it being fostering wholesome and skillful qualities? Is it allowing me to relinquish the unskillful, the unwholesome? There needs to be that kind of reflection, discernment being applied to the teachings. And it isn't the case that that just because one learns some of the teachings, or even all of the teachings, it necessarily frees one, because it does need to be applied. And again, this is what this gradual path is for, because there's always. And I think it's a really useful image that Ajahn Jeff came up with years and years ago, of feedback loops, where the teachings are feeding back on themselves. So you've got these constant feedback loops that are cycling back, so that just like this, where there's the, you know, the say faith is a river, and we're visiting a teacher. There's a constant looping back and reflecting, investigating, and seeing what's working, what's not working. Is it actually lining up with right view? Is it lining up with the goal of the practice? Is it lining up with the purpose of the Buddhist teachings? So that's a, you know, it's a really important aspect of of these teachings, because the Buddha is, how do you say, he has, and I think that's one of the things, for me anyway, that gives tremendous faith, is that the clarity with which the Buddha himself seems to have understood the path and the goal, and then being able to lay out a path of teaching and training, that one can follow that, but then continually be reflecting and investigating to make sure that one's on track. And as one say continues to investigate and reflect on these, and how one comes to the Dhamma, then there's a very good discourse that does cover this kind of the application of the sense of, you know, having faith, visiting a teacher, having the reflecting, hearing the Dhamma, and reflecting on it again, and that's in the Majjhima Nikaya, middle length discourses, Sutta number 95. And the Buddha has a discussion with a group of Brahmins, and it pretty soon, it begins with this group of Brahmins being brought by an elder leader within the Brahmin community. Then it turns into a bit of a discussion / debate of the kind of the authority and supremacy of the Brahmin tradition and the Brahmin teaching, the teachings within the Brahmin tradition, and then also the kind of the and where the Buddha takes it, then directs it, is toward the basis for establishing truth. And there's been this back and forth a bit, and then the Buddha, of course, is extremely precise and and then he's being, and he's very skilled in debate, so it ends up being with this particular Brahmin who is arguing the case, and finally the Buddha sort of says, Bharadvaja, which is a family name, Bharadvaja, first you took your stand on faith, now you speak of oral tradition. There are five things, Bharadvaja, that may turn out in two different ways here and now. What five? Faith, approval, in the sense of one's own approval of a particular stand or viewpoint. Oral tradition, reason cogitation, which is just through using logic, and reflective acceptance of a view. These five things may turn out in two different ways here now. Now, something may be fully accepted out of faith, yet it may be empty, hollow, and false. But something else may not be fully accepted out of faith, yet it may be factual, true, and unmistaken. And of course, the Buddha goes through those five different aspects of how we tend to pick up a particular viewpoint and have a particular understanding of either religious teachings or the world around us. And in the same way, even something may be something may be fully approved of. And it ends up sometimes it's true, sometimes it's not. Sometimes it may be really logical, well thought through, and doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be true. It just means it's logical. The same might be well reflected on, but the fact that we might have missed some key piece of it is we might have missed that completely. And the same with the having had a reflective acceptance of a view. Under these conditions, it is not proper for a wise person who preserves truth to come to the definite conclusion, only this is true, anything else is wrong. That makes an impression on this particular Brahmin. Then he begins to question the Buddha about the preservation of truth. And then the Buddha comes to back to the aspect of faith or of saddha. He said, if a person has faith, Bharadvaja, he preserves truth when he says, my faith is thus. But he does not yet come to the definite conclusion, only this is true, anything else is wrong. In this way, there's preservation of truth, in the sense that, okay, this is my faith is like this. And one doesn't say, my faith is like this, and then this is what's absolutely true, and everything else is really wrong. It's just that you've got faith in it. Sometimes the precision of the Buddha's mind, it just is... I love it.
Can I just comment on that?
Yeah.
The reason that three, that's so powerful is because the first one is faith.
Yeah.
And very often in the world, people who have very strong faith in something, like that can be, because their faith is so strong, they consider that evidence for its validity.
Oh, absolutely.
So it's like, it's almost like, because my faith is so, I'm so absolutely sure this is true.
Yeah.
They just, therefore it's true.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you see, in any religion...
That's mostly how what religion is about.
Yeah.
that's why there's so much sort of so many religious wars in the same way, in exactly the same way of that something that's been intelligently reflected on.
Oh yeah, that's the other one, sure.
Yeah.
Nice.
You really get into some good, some real good arguments go with that. And oftentimes it's really difficult to, both of those.
To dialogue with.
To actually dialogue with when any of those bases are, and the position is held, this is true. Only this is true. Everything else is wrong. And it's important to be able to that's why the aspect of questioning and this is why the gradual path. You're continually. You're not sort of building up faith. Faith is a tool to build up experience, and as you build up experience, then there begins to be clarity and conviction because of the experience, and even the experience is you have to keep questioning that as well, because it's only when when you really see in different circumstances that the habits of greed, hatred, and delusion are really undermined. But I think also the other aspect is that as this is a gradual path, as one continues in that gradual training, one is gaining a sense of the experience is supporting the confidence that yes, this works. There's more clarity and less confusion. There's more skillfulness and an increase in being able to step back from one's unskillful habits. There's more well-being and less dukkha. And so one keeps going forward because of that that asseveration of truth. So so in the same and sort of course the Buddha goes through that preservation of truth with those aspects in mind of and then he talks about a discovery of truth in the sense of, and that's by really investigating one's own mind, mental states, and understanding how one is really freeing oneself from unskillful actions of body, speech, and mind that are rooted in greed, hatred, and delusion. As one continues to recognize when investigating and recognizing, and this is in this sutta in particular, the Buddha is talking and saying that paying attention to a teacher and recognizing, okay, that person seems to be not so affected by greed, hatred, and delusion. And he said, and the Dhamma that this venerable one teaches is profound, to be experienced by the wise. This Dhamma cannot be easily taught by one who is affected by delusion or greed or hatred. So those are, by gaining that, and that's what there's a gaining of confidence. And that's what he said when he's investigated, seeing that is purified from states of, then he places faith in that teacher. Filled with faith, he visits, pays respects. Having paid respects, gives ear. When he gives ear, he hears the Dhamma. Having heard the Dhamma, memorizes it and examines the meaning of the teachings he's memorized. And when he examines their meaning, gains a reflective acceptance of those teachings. When he's gained a reflective acceptance of those teachings, zeal springs up, or desire, interest, chanda in Pali. When zeal has sprung up, he applies his will. So it just isn't. Again, there's a recognition that just because one's excited about a Dhamma teaching doesn't actually change you. Because if you get excited about it you actually have to apply your put forth an intention, put forth some kind of effort. Applying his will, he scrutinizes. Having scrutinized, he strives. Or these are all putting forth effort. But then the effort and resolution that one applies bears the fruit of experiencing truth and then seeing it, penetrating it with discernment, with wisdom. These are a natural progression. And then the Buddha says, and this is the, there's a, in this way one discovers truth. In this way, we describe the discovery of truth. He says, but yet there is no final arrival at truth. And then he's asked again, well, in what way is there this arrival at truth? And then the Buddha replies, he said, the final arrival at truth, Bharadvaja, lies in the repetition, development, and cultivation of those same things. So it's not complicated. It's not mystical. It's about applying those very teachings that he laid down in this gradual training. That clarification, that reviewing, that applying oneself to it. So those are aspects of the of this. And he said, in each of these different factors are a support for the other. He's saying, like, and it goes back and forth with question and answers. And since the Buddha is sort of saying, because he's asked, we asked Master Gona about the thing most helpful for the final arrival at truth. Even he's already been told, just apply all of that again and put your effort into it. Because I want the specifics. And then the Buddha's answer is, well, striving or putting forth effort is most helpful for the final arrival of truth. If one does not strive or put forth effort, one will not arrive at truth. But because one strives, one does finally arrive at truth. And then he asks, well, what's most helpful for striving? So then it goes on. Basically, he backs right up again in the sense of scrutiny, a careful reflection. And all these different aspects of examination, reflection, really weighing the results of the practice, and then, of course, it comes from a certain theoretical basis in the sense of one studies and memorizes and investigates the teachings and that learning of the teachings, and of course that comes from drawing close to one who is has some experience in the teachings. So that's kind of an overview of, and we say, the coming to the Dhamma and those applications of investigation and study and that's in Thailand, when you're listening to teachings, you'll oftentimes hear of the sort of three different aspects of the teaching. So there's study, practice, realization. So that there needs to be some kind of theoretical foundation, some kind of framework for one's view and one's understanding. Then one has to put forth some effort in terms of practice, training, development of this path, and then there's a natural fruit that arises from that, and it's similar to say the image that Ajahn Chah would always use would be the one of the having the planting a fruit tree or fruit orchard, and you the first thing that you do is, you dig a hole, you prepare the soil, you fertilize the soil, you water you put the tree in, you water the tree, you pick the bugs, you keep looking after that tree, and it's natural that whatever you plant there, it'll grow if you look after it properly. And then when and how it gives fruit will depend on the kind of tree it is. And so that And you put tomatoes in, and, you know, you get tomatoes pretty quickly. So you put walnuts in, it takes quite a long time. So it's just quite natural that there's these differences in how the... the principles are the same in the sense that the fruit arises from those causes that are well looked after. So that gives overview of coming to Dhamma.